This is the Voice of Freedom.
And during the few moments that we have left, we want to talk right down to earth in a language that everybody here can easily understand.
Allow me to turn this up to 11. I was born this way. This is who I am. I'm tired of being nice. I am the one true, genuine article in a business full of counterfeit bucks. This has never been a popularity contest. I will always speak truth to power. I am the truth, and the truth is painful. We are different kids, but we have the same heartbeat. One pulse, one pulse.
We are dying for a change.
I got the time and I ain't going anywhere. Tell me when I'm telling lies.
Lynyrd Skynyrd, ZZ Top, 38 Special, all those guys owe everything to black American folk and blues musicians.
Well, what it sounded like before black people, which was the wet, sloppy sounds of fucking your sister.
Okay, so that's my turn. Which one of you dumb sister fucking tiki torch carrying sloths from the Goonies looking pieces of shit wants to go next?
I was born lonely at Christ Hospital, blue in the face with the cord around my neck, because they've been trying to kill me since the day I was born, and they ain't found the man enough to do it yet, and you ain't him. I will become a monster to fight the monsters of the world. Everybody wants to be the champ until it's time to do champ shit. I promise I'm gonna keep doing it until the wheels fall off. Tell me when I'm telling lies.
You'll never be able to say that your brother lied to you, Jack.
What is the haps, Hep Cadets, Cats, and Kittens? Give me five on the black and inside. It's the Higgity Higgity host with the most, Moxie O'Brien, back again with another episode of Come and See here on another Friday morning in America. What's Higgity Higgity happening, everybody? It's my creation. Is it real? I do not know. Oingo boingo. See, that feels forced now, because on the last episode of the show, I told you that I recorded that once already and decided not to use it. So it doesn't feel like a whimsical, offhanded aside that I quoted Oingo Boingo, which sort of, if I can be completely candid, defeats the entire purpose of quoting fucking Oingo Boingo. Anyway, welcome back. I wanted to touch base with you again semi-quickly after taking such a long time off. We had discussed the possibility of a Mox Speaks episode in between the next researched episode of the show, which is underway. I think I've decided to go with the Beer Hall Pooch for the next episode of research for the show. I've got something under the hood about Vince McMahon, but I'm still sort of anticipating a lot of things coming out about that, and for that reason am somewhat loath to put it out just yet. So I might actually sit on that one for a while until I feel comfortable that more information won't be out within a week of me releasing it, which is actually what happened when I did the last one, if you remember that. I've also got something regarding borders and immigration that I've been working on for a couple of, well, about a month and a half now, actually, but that's not done yet, and it's going to end up being fairly long, I think, and I was kind of hoping to get the episode length down on a few episodes before I drop something that's going to be like 4 or 5 hours on you again. You know, I have heard feedback from some of the listeners that the longer episodes are actually rather popular, but it's also good to remember that once upon a time, this show was like an hour long and we talked about like aliens and psychics and shit. So I do want to do service to the listeners who like that stuff as much as the political conspiracy things. After all, as the black leftist Bill Cooper, I do have to recognize that that I tread on both sides of that fence, if you will. You know, I gotta be all right. I say the black leftist Bill Cooper, and that's been such a you know, a thing since the very beginning of the show. I mean, look at the name of the fucking show. The first three episodes of the show were explaining my strange relationship to my dear old Uncle Bill, of course. And as time goes on, that continues to be something of a canary in the coal mine for me in how my my views evolve and how I relate to some of the material that I cover, how I identify and move through the world as a leftist, as an anarchist, as an anti-statist, these sorts of things, as a parody of a sovereign citizen. I really should stop saying that. You know, I think that it's come to, you know, I've talked previously about how it's important to me. Maybe I haven't talked here actually. That it's very important to me to deconstruct these layers, these systems, this sort of personal hierarchy of identity to become something that is entirely internally defined, you know, entirely constructed by self and not outward ideas and concepts and whatnot. I think that that's sort of where true freedom actually comes from, is becoming completely untethered from outward definition. And part of that is this Bill Cooper business, right? That I think that we've expanded beyond that in a lot of ways. You know, I it's still relevant. Don't get me wrong. My grounding as a thinker in the Cooper tradition of conspiracy, I think, will always be relevant to how the material is looked at on this show. And of course, that's where a lot of my history comes from, I think, with the material that I cover is this conspiratorial space and some of the aesthetic, the 90s sort of dark and broody psychedelia whatnots is very much a Mystery Babylon influence. That's definitely part of it. But I think that I don't want to be more, I would like to be more than just the sum of my parts. So I don't know if Black Bill Cooper is appropriate, even insofar as I'm not a man. So, I don't know, not so much the black left Bill Cooper, so much as just the only Moxie O'Brien that currently has a podcast that discusses fascism. Which, by the way, won an award this week from somebody, Free Scoop? Scoop? Free Info? Something? Somebody named Come and See one of the top 30 podcasts about fascism on the internet this week. And that's lovely. I've never heard of the publication. I am, for all intents and purposes, a complete and total hermit, except whenever my very lovely partner and I go out to dinner or something of that nature. That reminds me, It was recently brought to my attention that one of the three most Googled things about Moxie O'Brien were who I'm seeing. Bless you all. I am seeing someone, and they are quite lovely. If you're listening, love you very much. Yeah, so I guess that cat's out of that bag, apparently, because people have been Googling it. That's a weird thing, by the way, to realize that people have been Googling your age and who you're dating. But whatever. I was saying something once upon a time before I got very much derailed by myself saying other things. This is still just the intro, but it's also a Mox Speaks thing because, again, we haven't talked in a while, and I wanted to discuss some things, but also explain, you know, I don't talk about me much on this show. It's not really about me. I think that who I am and where how I grew up and those kinds of things probably inform my perspective, to be sure, but it's less about me than it is about what I'm trying to tell you. So I'm sort of a background character to the show. So it's weird to intend on discussing myself, but I guess I opened that door with the Q&A thing last season, right? I mentioned that, well, fuck, I guess the intro's over and we're just getting into it. We're just gonna, just no foreplay whatsoever, eh, Mox? There we go. Well, the exes could confirm that. I'm kidding. Anyway, I mentioned that I'd experienced some loss in the family and that I'd been really having a lot of difficulty, you know, grappling with that emotionally. You know, I'm not close with family, really. I'm not particularly close with most people in general. I'm sort of a very and it's weird as a person who's been in bands, done theater, worked in radio, used to DJ, now does this, did stand-up comedy. I'm a very, very private person when I'm not working. And for that reason, I've always had like a very, very small, but very, very tight-knit group of, you know, a personal support system, I guess, you know, surrogate family, FGM, Nico, love you both, Aria, love you too, you know, it's, oh, Jean, love you, Jenny, love you too, it's, family's difficult for me, you know, I wasn't close with biological family for the most part. I wasn't close with adopted family either. I still have a lot of hang-ups about some of how I was raised interpersonally by both of those groups of people. And you know, it's a weird thing to reckon with that when you're getting up there in age. And don't tell me that 40 is not old. Old is how you feel, and I feel 110. So it's difficult to reckon with this idea that you have issues with family as an adult, especially when those people all start dying. You know, this isn't the first member of the immediate family to die in recent years, and my adopted father currently has cancer and has been going through chemo treatments for the past few months. This is part of the age thing, right? That, you know, people, this is what happens to people eventually. And I think that this is something that many of the listeners will be able to relate to, perhaps, that because my childhood was the way that it was, my teens and 20s were of a sort that I and most people who knew me didn't think I would make it to 30. And now, you know, almost a full decade on from 30, there's a lot of life experiences, feelings, and circumstances that I never anticipated having to reckon with in this way, you know, and among them is getting older with family whenever you may or may not have resentment things, you may or may not have, old difficulties, you know, especially speaking as, for the adopted side of things, as a non-white person, a very far left person, a queer person, a non-binary person with very traditional relatives. The act of even attempting to hold space for yourself in an environment where no one else in the room even has like a reference point for what you are, nor necessarily wants to do the work to get same. It can be exhausting. My choice typically when faced with those sorts of situations is to opt out rather than push through. You know, there's enough general adversity in day-to-day life without creating extra for yourself where one need not, if you dig what I mean. And for that reason, my brother, who just died in November, I think. No, it was October. Fuck, no. October, I think. It's time is strange. It's been a few months, at any rate. He and I really hadn't spoken in years. You know, my relationship to that family, particularly as an AMAB person growing up, was always that this person who had gone to and finished college had gone to business school, had gotten whatever the degree you get after your college degree is, in international business, was making 6-7 figures a year, had a very good house, was married, etc., 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 was that I should be stop being so weird and be more like him. That this was the ideal, you know, the successful, the married with the thing, he was going to have kids, that never happened. All of that stuff. And of course, you know, I went to prison, chose a very unconventional career path, which was not supported by family at all whatsoever, in, you know, live performance, whether it was music or stand-up or whatever. Family's never been supportive of that because it wasn't a real job. Did my own thing, kind of went off on my own. And he sort of cracked under the pressure of being the white male ideal, and the wife left, that the house went away, the job went away, and all that was left was the drinking for about 25 years. And eventually that's what killed him. He drank himself to death. In the house while I was there, I sat in the room with the body for several hours. We talked. I think I said some of what I needed to say. But it's difficult to reckon with. I think Western society has these preconceptions about how you're supposed to deal with death and grief. And when your experience emotionally, which is truth, doesn't align with that, there's some sort of clash you know, within you. At least there was for me, or is for me, because this isn't something that's unusual for me. I don't often have the typical reaction to death and grief that you're supposed to have, or at least is socially expected of you. It's a whole miasma of emotions that one deals with, and it's difficult to reckon with whether the things you're feeling are wrong. And of course, your feelings aren't wrong. I think sometimes it's good to maybe question why you're having them, or where they came from, or what they mean, but they're not necessarily wrong. I'm big on doing the mental work, and it took me a bit of time away from communicating with other people while I was processing what my relationship with my brother meant to me, and if I was comfortable with it being what it had been. And I think there are people who take the shit that I say seriously. Some of you are probably laughing at the idea that I question that, but I think that, some of the emails and things that I've gotten over the years have suggested that there are young people that perhaps take some of the things that I say seriously and perhaps learn something, God forbid, from me. I am not a role model. I think at my age, if there is something I wish I had known when I was younger, it's that there's not a right way to deal with shit. Dig, that sounds terrible already. I'm already concerned that I've fucked this up. There are probably unhealthy ways to deal with things. I mean that the way you're feeling is not wrong. You see what I mean? That if you're the kind of person who has been perhaps bullied by life or by parentage or something, conditioning, into believing that your feelings might be wrong. Your feelings are never wrong. You feel how you feel for a reason, and you don't owe anyone an apology for that. And it's okay to hold space for those feelings, even if it's just within yourself. Perhaps it's not appropriate to push your feelings onto anyone else if that's not something that they seem to be there for at the moment. You don't need to make your experience or make everyone else's experience about you, but your experience, your feelings are valid. And also, there's not a right way to live, necessarily. You can't. And I think that this was something that really helped me a lot whenever I finally came to this understanding myself, that the worst thing you can do is compare yourself to other people. That it's, you will always fail at being someone else. Do you dig what I mean? You are the only you. And so It's precious that you be you, that what you contribute can't come from anyone else, that your lived experiences, your perspective, all of the things that come together to make you the snowflake that you are. Fuck me, when did I become a motivational speaker? There's only one of those, and it's important to lean on the things that make you you more than the things that you have necessarily in commonality with everybody else. I cooked for a while. It taught me a lot, I think, about discipline under pressure and things of that nature that aren't necessarily bad things to know, even if I abhor discipline. And I think that one of those things is that, you know, in an overcrowded market, if you will, it's important to have something that no one else has if you want to garner attention. And you, my precious little snowflakes, all have something no one else has. You are all the only you out there. Lean into that. You know, stop feeling like a failure because you don't have this person's outfit or this person's nails or this person's car or this person's bank account or that person's ass or this person's abs or that person's TV deal or maybe that person got more money than you for that gig. Yes, I am talking to myself. All of those kinds of things. It's not about those people. You will always fail at trying to be someone else. You can still fail at lying to yourself and everyone else. So why bother? Be you. At least then when you fail, you do it honestly. And you can learn from it because you know what you would have done in that situation. You know, there's real power in just saying, fuck it, I'm me. And I think that if I hope young people learn anything from any of this shit, perhaps it's that. You know, in addition to the familial things, there's depression and anxiety, of course. I've talked a bit about being a neurodivergent person and having some mental instability, not mental instability. I don't know what word I want to use at the moment, but I do struggle with some things, and it's very difficult as a person who sort of prides themselves on being self-motivated and driven, I think. And that's also a difficult thing to reckon with, because what am I driving at sometimes is a problem for me, especially as a person who has sort of an unconventional view of what success would be. I have no desire to be rich. I have no desire to accumulate things. I have no real desire for popularity either. So what is success then if you don't want any of those things? And what am I driving at? Well, education. Really, change, I think. And how do you quantify those things? And that, honestly, is a question that spirals me out sometimes. And am I contributing to these conversations positively, or am I just more trauma porn for people to ingest? You know, I worry about that as well, because that's not my goal. I understand that there is a degree of negativity one needs to sift through to understand how capital F fucked everything got, but the trauma's not the point. It's very important to recognize that there are things on the other side of that, and for that reason, even while dealing with the depression and the anxiety and the other things, it's important to remember not to get hopeless. You know, I think I mentioned on the last episode of the show that one of the reasons I took such a long break from putting anything out was that it was important to me not to mainline hopelessness into my audience. And I mean that. I think that there's a level of responsibility in having a platform that behooves me not to dump misery on people whenever what I'm attempting to do is hopefully radicalize people towards positive communal and social change. So if I don't know if I can think positively, it's almost the responsible thing for me to do to not say anything, which might be a lesson that some people could learn from. Sometimes the most helpful thing you could do is shut the fuck up. You know, depression has been a problem for me for as long as I can remember. Even before I think I knew what depression was. The same can be said for anxiety. That, you know, as a kid growing up in, you know, what felt like unfriendly, unsafe, unwelcoming environments a lot of the time, knowing what was anxiety and what was, oh, we just probably shouldn't be here right now, was difficult in and of itself. Knowing what was sad versus what was chemical, also a problem. In an unsupportive, emotionally, environment especially, as a child of the 80s, where they just said that you talked too much and put you on Ritalin, I don't think I started to genuinely reckon with my emotions and what they meant until I was probably in my late 20s and had stopped drinking. And mostly had stopped doing drugs. You know, that's another thing I don't really talk about ever on this show, that, you know, I joke very, very much about being a psychonaut and sort of psychedelic expression and discovery, and I am very much an advocate of those things and have spent most of my life identifying that way, but at this point in my life, I'm really off all of the hard stuff. I've done everything, but I've also survived all of those things, and I that's not where I am in life anymore. So it's at first it was difficult to sort of you know, realize that I had an emotional register as a semi-sober person. But over time, recognizing that, you know, at my age, which was, you know, in probably my late 20s at that point, I hadn't really reckoned with things like boundaries, with, you know, self-control, with, or what I thought that meant, with a lot of things that I think make for a healthy adult life experience. And now that I think that I've done several years of that work, it's easier to deal with the psychological and emotional stuff than it was before, when my solution was to just do blow about it. But it's still, when you've spent so much of your life with that being how you cope with not knowing how to feel, actually sitting with not knowing how to feel and fucking, I've used the word several times, I know, but reckoning with that is important, but painful and difficult. So I needed to do that. And also the emotional strain I haven't talked much about on the show. The Gazan genocide and what it's meant for family, and just it's like having your heart ripped out in a country where you are inundated with news and opinion about how that family are terrorists and monsters and thieves and savages, while you see dead and dismembered children and people who can't get water and towns where all of the buildings have been destroyed. And this is, I didn't plan to transition, but here we are. Fuck it. This is the nature of the no script. That it is difficult for me as a person, especially who's somewhat of a political identity, to see the politicization of human lives, badly, might I add, badly by everyone, and just the way that spiraling out emotionally resulted from these people, these lives, all of these dead people, these dead children, all of this death and destruction and terror is just a political football for a bunch of very rich white people in the West, typically on every side of the conversation, really, because let's be honest, if you're white and you live here, whose fucking land is it? So it's I think sometimes there's a tendency to, I hate the word over-empathize, but when you have that family, that emotional connection, that it's sort of direct line to so much tragedy, it's especially when there doesn't appear to be any sort of relief in the near future, and especially in the context of an election year where situations like this become heavily politicized, to be thrown in your fucking face over and over and over again by people who don't understand them, don't care what they mean, have don't see people in any of this footage or these pictures or anything that it's promo work. You know, it's the carny of American politics, and I hate it. I hate it passionately. I hate it. That anyone could sincerely get behind any of these opportunistic, glory hound, my dog skip ass motherfuckers is staggering to me. That you, anyone, you, the royal you, whatever the fuck, could look at Donald Trump or Joe Biden. I know there's a brown lady running, but this is the United States of America, and let's be fucking serious. Joe Biden or Donald Trump, and say to yourself, this represents me. This decrepit war horse cancer of a human being, this would-be nationalist fascist white trash, this European reject, this inbred motherfucker, this represents you. If you can say that with a straight face, there's something deeply, deeply wrong with you. And if you're able to get it up for that, I pity you. I do, because there's no solutions in either of those things. It doesn't matter what hat you wear. It doesn't matter if you like the donkey or the elephant or the horse or the parrot or whatever the goddamn fucking... the mascots don't matter. The teams don't matter. Because at the end of the day, none of them, beyond a certain economic threshold, are going to do anything that will affect you positively either fucking way. And yeah, there's a lot of people who are going to try to guilt trip you into voting for old guy number one in the blue suit because old guy number two in the brown suit is a fascist. And yeah, he kind of is. Old guy number one in the blue suit, also kind of a fascist and even more of a hawk than old guy number two in the brown suit, who quotes Adolf Hitler and reads Vladimir Putin and things of that nature. You know, we talked, what, two seasons ago when we covered David Duke about the problem in the United States of America with the lesser of two evils conversation and how that doesn't serve anyone. And somehow in this, the last chapter of the America book, it feels like we've hit the quintessential, this election doesn't serve anybody, in that you are stuck between two old, out of touch, demented white terrorists who have no one's best interest in mind but their own, probably don't even know where the fuck they are half the time, and one of them's a rapist and one of them's a war criminal. So, who wins is my question. What's the fucking point? And this is in February when you're about to spend the next March, April, May, June, July, August, September, October, 9 months hearing about this every day of your life. And neither one of these men is worth shit. Their parties aren't worth shit. Some of you have been talking at length for going on, what, 16 years now? About how Bernie Sanders is the great white hope. Guess who's out here telling everybody that what we need to do is not call it a genocide? Bernie Sanders. Guess who else won't call it a genocide? Alexandria Cortez. These people aren't your friends. They're not heroes. They're not going to help you. They're not good guys. They're not the white hats. And they're not the solution to your fucking problems. They are the personification of the continuation of the very problem in question. By engaging with the electoral process, you were acknowledging that the American system should continue to operate as it does. This is a three-card Monty. Do all of you know what three-card Monty is? It's an old Carney game. It's three cards, or, you know, perhaps something under a cup, whatever. And you're supposed to guess which of the cards is the queen. The trick is, none of the cards is ever the queen. You lose as soon as you start playing. That's what American politics is. You lose by engaging. The solution is to come up with sustainable systems outside of the political framework that actually benefit the community, because the community has no benefit to the state. The state actually functions better if you stop thinking of yourselves as a community and start thinking of yourselves as a labor force. So there's no real hope in politics. And as a person who doesn't want to dump hopelessness on my audience, but does discuss politics, where does that leave me? I can't tell you to vote for somebody. Cornel West is running. I'm a fan of his to some extent. As much as can be said, I'm a fan of anyone at this point. I like Cornel West. I don't think he would be effective as a president, and I don't think that having a president would fix anything. I don't think we need presidents. I don't think the solution is government. I don't think the solution is states. You know, I think that viewing these issues, particularly some of the more preeminent issues like the environmental problems, require us to stop looking at these things like separate states and countries and more like a global community that is affected by the fact that, you know, it's getting hotter all the time and lots of places around the world are going to be too hot for people to live soon. So, in a sense, my feelings really transcend the concept of is this a political conversation? And that's another one of the reasons that, you know, I needed to take some time away, because perhaps I needed to reevaluate what it is I even thought I was fucking doing here. That if the point is there is a problem, what is the problem? How do we fix it? And I have somehow stopped at there is a problem. Am I failing in what I set out to do? And to some extent, fucking yeah, I think I am. So there's other things that are essential parts of this conversation that I started a few years ago that I think I have to give voice and space and service to. And part of that is solutions. You know, what now? You know, on the last episode of the show, we talked quite a bit about how many people in this country, the United States, are divorced from a fundamental sense of reality by living in an alternative world with alternative facts and an alternative history. And what do you do about that? And one of the things that was discussed in one of the pieces that was read on that episode was that, you know, material conditions are a very big part of this problem, that happy people don't embrace a lot of these antisocial, anti-human negative ideologies. And sure, there's something to be said for that. But the people who are already involved need to be confronted head on in a way that de-escalates the radicalization, de-radicalizes something. And, you know, as a person who talks to, you know, right-wingers, to, you know, 2A enthusiasts, sovereign citizens, people of that nature, with some success, I feel like I could be contributing more to that conversation than I probably did. That I think that there are not rhetorical devices, but things that are important to recognize that perhaps I don't make plain enough in the show. And one of them, of course, is that a lot of these people on the right learned from people or were themselves used to be leftists. That there are a lot of, in particular, former Marxists in the American right wing. A lot of people who defected from the SDS, a lot of people who become disenfranchised with the CPUSA, people who want to see meaningful systemic changes, and I suppose at some point don't necessarily care how they get there if they see that one group possibly has the means and financial backing and the potential infrastructure to do so, are more willing to do that than perhaps work with people that they once upon a time had more common cause with. Mike Vanderbo, fantastic example of this. Mike Vanderbo's entire MO is that he was a reformed Marxist. I dispute that as someone who'd met Mike several times, but that is part of his personal narrative, that he, the founder of the Three Percenters and the Oath Keepers, was a reformed, in his words, reformed Marxist. And, you know, so there's something to be said for You know, he's an example. Arthur Desmond, someone we're going to cover later this season, and his work Might Makes Right under the pseudonym Ragnar Redbeard, is another, you know, former labor organizer and leftist. Alan Pinkerton, he who founded the Pinkerton Detective Agency, former leftist, also one of the most infamous anti-labor figures in history. So there's a lot of leftist thinking and influence that goes into the right wing. We've talked in the past about the Little White Book, about how much of right-wing insurgency traces to things like Mao, or the Little Red Book, and Mao's framework for guerrilla warfare and revolutionary insurgency. So there are ways in which people on the far right, even if they don't realize it, are predisposed to hear what you have to say if what you're doing is speaking to them about leftism, about communalism, these things. That's really what, especially these people in rural areas, if you actually talk to them and you get beyond dogma and buzzwords, what they want is strong community and a government that they get something out of if they're paying into it. You know, that seems to be, generally speaking, something that most Americans would acknowledge that they want out of an elected government. At the end of the day, is if I'm paying you, give me things that I need for the money that I pay you. And I want to feel safe and welcome where I live. I think that's the real American dream, unattainable as it may sound these days. You know, whether you're conservative or not, there's something to be said for that. And I think that if you look at the ways in which there are broad similarities more than the vast differences, because the differences are usually things that have been propagandized by the state or other various control systems, religions, organizations, political groups, whatever. And the person really just wants to belong somewhere in a society that has made that something that everyone feels, because it's the easiest way to sell you shit. If you don't feel like you belong, or you feel like you need something to fill a hole inside yourself or something with which to identify, we can sell you an identity that has all kinds of fucking accessories. That's the American way. You know, okay, your family doesn't get you, and you feel socially isolated and alienated. Perhaps you're a goth. Here's 9 places that you can shop and 1,000 different things that you can buy to tell the world who you are. And oh, here's all of the ways that you behave like the thing that you are, just in case you weren't sure how you are supposed to be yourself. That'll be $9.99. And, you know, so on goes the commodification of the self and the wholesale buying and purchasing of the real market of ideas is not what they told you it was on YouTube. It's where Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk tell you what you're thinking this week. There's the Bill Cooper. We weren't sure where it went. There it is. Anyway, I think that, like I was saying, in the spirit of solutions and actually addressing these problems in a substantive way and contributing to the conversation, I wanted to make sort of an announcement on this episode of the show that later this year, I'll be launching a second podcast. There's a few different names in contention. I think Reap the Whirlwind is probably what we'll end up going with, though. I'm a big fan of that one because it involves consequences. But I'm going to be interviewing people, talking to different activists, talking to other experts in different fields, hopefully some psychologists, lawyers, even some politicians, actually, about some of the things that we talk about on Come and See Here, and maybe what we can do about them in real substantive ways. So I've started reaching out to different people to set up interviews for that. I'll be continuing to do that over the next few months, and also trying to record material for that when and where I have time to do so. But that'll be out later this year. I've been kind of kicking around this idea for a while. It's just been, it takes my mind time sometimes to fully formulate what it wants to do, and I don't like to announce things until I'm pretty sure that they're going to happen. I know that this show is a very, very horrible example of that because I change my mind all the goddamn time, but this is something that I think is important to contribute to the broader broader conversation that we've started here. So look for that, and that'll be great, I guess. I don't fucking know. It's a wonderful way to hype your audience up for a new thing you're going to do, Mox. Yeah, check it out, you fuckers. I don't know. Jesus Christ. I'm not housebroken. I don't know what to tell you. So I guess that in conclusion, because this was just one long continuous thought, right? I don't know. In conclusion, I think that it's important to try to ask, what the fuck do I think it's important to do? What do I think it's important to do? Wash your hands and take care of each other. I don't know. I do think that we should be cognizant of these things and not just dig up the problems, but also try to have ways of dealing with them. So with any luck, that's what I'm hoping to do this year. And there'll be other new show thing announcements in the future, because that's not the only one. That's just the one that'll probably be happening first. So I guess that I feel better, you know, overall. The energy level in here feels pretty good. I don't like to gauge how things are going based off how I've felt at other points throughout the show, because it's always an evolving thing. This is definitely not the same show that it was when I started it 2 years ago. But that's good, because it wasn't good when I started it 2 years ago. I don't even know if it's good now. I just think it's better than it was. Certainly more people are listening to it, which probably accounts for something. I think that being in a better place emotionally, in a better place psychologically, has allowed me to be in a better place for the show, for the new relationship thing. Again, hi, with everything, and I'm very excited to be here. I really am. It's, you know, the having fans thing is a weird bit, right? That especially as a very, very private person, having people you know, cheer you on is strange. But I do thank you all for that, and for bearing with me through this very, very difficult psychological journey that I've been on. But I think that it's going to lead to my ability to keep this show being what it has been, And I think that that is important, at least to me and a handful of other folks. And for now, that's good enough for me. That's really all I have for you. This wasn't going to be long. These Mox Speaks things never really are, because they're more about just touching base with the listeners outside of the context of here's a shitload of things that I need to teach you real quick. I wanted to, for all of the people who've sort of loyally been checking for where I was, were perhaps worried. I did get some lovely messages from people. I am fine now. Thank you all. And as the kids say, we are so back. Let's do the pitch. Yeah, let's do the pitch thing. Is that what the... Yeah, fuck it. We'll do the pitch. I mentioned on the last episode of the show that I'm doing something differently with advertising moving forward, that I'm going to be doing sort of native advertising, in a manner of speaking. That if you, the listener, have a product or business or something of that nature you'd like me to pitch on the show for you, I'd be interested in doing that, perhaps. Hit me up on the emails and things at Moxie O'Brien, M-O-X-Y, traditional Irish spelling, O-B-R-I-E-N, @gmail.com, and let's chop up some business stuff. We can talk about rates and what your product is and whether or not I think it's harmful to children and would be comfortable selling it on the show. Outside of that, if you are a fan of this thing of ours and you would like to become a contributing member of the Hep Cult, you can do so by going to www.patreon.com/comeandseepod. There will also be a link in the episode description. I forget to say that like every fucking time I do this. I swear to God. But there's several different options. Yeah, right. Totally derailed the ad read. Fine. It's not a read. I'm just doing it. There's several different options available as far as pay tiers. For example, there is a one-time donation option if you'd just like to kick some ducats my way because you thought I had a great day that day and let's throw the kids some cash. Or if you'd like to become a monthly contributor, that's also an option that's available to you. All subscribers immediately receive a download link to the Uncle Bill mixtape, something that I made a couple of seasons ago that is, similar to the intro music to this episode, but all the, CM Punk clips would be Bill Cooper. Also, there's going to be Patreon exclusive content coming very, very soon. I've been working on doing sort of an updated review of the Marvel Universe, doing like movie reviews for the Marvel thing, except it's crazy how badly all of those aged and how not good they are. And I mean that, like, starting with Robert Downey Jr. making bad trans jokes in like the first Iron Man, because that came out in 2008 and that was still okay in 2008. Was it 2008 or was it 2012? It doesn't matter. So that's a bit of a slog because most of those movies are shit. Although, you know, Echo was not bad in my opinion. So I'm toying with what Patreon exclusive content was going to be and be looking for us on the YouTubes soon. As soon as we figure out what the fuck that's going to be, we'll be over there as well. If you would like to wear your support for the Come and See podcast, you can do so by going to comeandseemerch.bigcartel.com. I almost forgot what the fucking website was. I have, the shirts are sort of back ordered right now, but I'm working on fulfilling back orders of those. I think I have at least, several that need sent out still, but that's coming. And I'm also in the process of working on some new merch designs, some new things that'll be available, and possibly an all new merch store where the printing of the shirts doesn't actually cost me more money than it does to sell the shirts. So that's also on the way. But we'll be back. Same Mox time, same Mox channel. On the next episode of the show, we're going to be talking about the Beer Hall Putsch, which is sort of the failed insurrection attempt by Hitler and the Nazis leading into the seizure of power by Hitler and the Nazis. And maybe, you know, how that's not that different from the whole January 6th thing, and how there being virtually no repercussions of any kind whatsoever to a planned overthrow of the government led to a planned and successful overthrow of the government. So we'll be doing that on the next episode of the show. You know, keep a weather eye. That'll probably be up Sunday or Monday. I've already started working on it here. But in the meantime, concentrate on the HEP, everybody. I have been Moxie O'Brien. This has been Come and See, and I will catch all of you beautiful HEP cats and kittens on the flip side. Smooches, deuces, dig it, baby.
We're smoking that IBM quantum computer. Chopper small and sturdy, built like Wilmer Valderrama. This Henny making me want to go to the mall and do something crazy.
I'm finished.